I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Wood Talk. Now here are three guys who have chiseled good looks in their joinery. Mark, Shannon, and Matt.
All right, so it's show 500, and today we're answering more of your dumb questions. Actually, you guys sent us some real ones, so we appreciate that.
Actual dumb questions, perfect.
Actual dumb questions this time. And to celebrate 500 episodes of this dumb show, we're going to do a celebratory woodworking quiz. Because, you know, like, how else can you celebrate but just ask yourself stupid woodworking questions? I don't know. I can't think of anything better to do than that. That's right. All right. So before we get to all that fun stuff, I want to let you know that Wood Talk is brought to you by Rockler. Rockler has been helping customers create with confidence for over 65 years. Rockler is giving away a new product every month to one lucky Wood Talk listener. This month, it's their handy Material Mate panel cart and shop stand, which can smoothly roll sheet stock from your storage rack or vehicle to the table saw or be used as a mobile workstation. Enter for your chance to win before May 1st at rockler.com/woodtalk. And while you're there, check out their National Woodworking Month sale, which is going on right now.
Woo! Yay! And if you want to help support the show, you can do so by going to patreon.com/woodtalk and signing up to become a patron of the show. This episode, we'd like to thank Jeremiah Carter, Andy Morin, Lyle Gordon, Travis... Yep, Schwieger? Sure, I don't know.
Schweiger.
Cool. Luke, Dorna, and D. Miles.
All right, so let's get to what's on the bench. And I've personally been gearing up for tons of veneering. It wasn't really veneering, but on the gaming desks that I made, I had glued wood to plexiglass, if you guys remember.
I mean, that's veneering.
Kind of veneering-ish.
Same process.
But I used the vacuum bag, and it reminded me how much I love that process. So I made sure that the next project I did, you know, involved some kind of legit veneering. So I am getting my fill on this, and I probably will get sick of it and not do it again for 10 years after this is done.
Legit veneering. Legit. I like it. The other thing was just nothing.
No, I don't count that. I'm talking like commercial veneer, stitching it together. It's the whole process, right?
Are you going to do any patterns?
Don't
or are you just doing like full
on
sheets?
The wood movement issue.
Yeah. No.
Well, what I'm actually going to do is it's kind of a weird design in a way. It's a little experimental, at least for me, in terms of like, this is not classic woodworking, design language that I'm using here. I'm just trying some things that are new for me. So there's going to be a series of doors and drawers. It's a vertical cabinet, very skinny kind of cabinet. I think I mentioned this before. It's the potato onion pantry thing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's actually going to be doors and drawers in a sort of frame and panel, style, but imagine taking the styles away. So it's only going to have rails at the top and the bottom, and the grain on the panels will be continuous vertical grain all the way through the piece. Even though the piece is normally, you might run that grain horizontally. The veneer sheets are going to be continuous from top to bottom. And I'm just basically going to like pre-veneer larger panels and then cut them down. It's also going to be one of those where I pre-edge the plywood and veneer right up to that edge so that you have solid wood already on there. Once you like flush trim and get this whole thing set up, you've got the veneer that transitions right into that solid edging. So no substantial edge profile on this. It's going to be more of a sort of a modern design, I guess, in that sense.
That's going to be in us. I don't know. We're going to see. I don't know how I feel about that yet. I think it's one of those things you got to like see it for real.
I don't know how I feel about it.
Feels like that might look really weird, but maybe it'll look awesome. I don't know.
Well, that's what this is. Like my mom doesn't, stylistically, she's not real picky. And that's the cool thing. Actually, a lot of people who I build for in the family just want me to make something for them. And as long as it functions and serves the purpose, they kind of don't care what it looks like. So it gives me free rein to be goofy.
That's good.
Well, here's the thing. I was looking for some ideas. I wanted to do something a little bit different. I was leafing through an old fine woodworking gallery book, I think it was. And I just saw this one cabinet that the front doors had a continuous rail. So it was, you know, a continuous rail that's been split in the middle to create two doors. And then a, you know, simple panel, but it didn't have any styles at all. And I was thinking when it comes to apply a small, you know, it's not a very large one, but a small veneered plywood door, why do you actually need rails? You know, if it's not structurally important, they really don't really need to be there. So if you want to do something on a smaller scale and try taking those rails away and see if you could establish some cool visual effect with that, it would be fun to try. So that's all it is. It's just an experiment. It could be an absolute failure, but it's going to work even if it doesn't look great. It'll do what my mom needs it to do. And that's kind of the most important
thing. There we go. Yeah.
Doing it for science.
I do it so you guys don't have
to.
Just
for science. I like that.
So that's pretty much it for me. So Matt, you sound tired. What do you got going on?
I'm always tired. I feel like I'm always tired. I have been moving again still. However long it's been since I started moving. Feels like it. It's like a never ending thing. Oh man. So I just finished today. I brought over the last load of slabs. So that's all out of the yard. I moved my sawmill. I think that was 2 weeks ago, something like that. It's all like a blur now. It's a messy blur. And I've been converting my shop into a garage, which sounds silly.
Yeah. Putting your old shop back into normal garage state.
Yes. Making it into a garage. Yes. Cause normally like you convert a garage into a shop. No, I'm going the other way. We're going to undo all of the Shopify things that I did. Ooh. And make it a place to park cars again.
But boring. Speaking of not boring, you bought a new toy.
Boring.
Like,
so in a nutshell,
like this dominates Matt's Instagram. Like, honey, go to the newspaper.
Yeah. That's all I'm doing.
That's all it is.
I got to put some hours on these things.
Yeah,
I
thought.
Oh my gosh. Well, the story with that one was that my dad and I were hanging sheetrock all day. And Lindsay had come by the old house to take my truck out to Home Depot to pick up the stuff and then left it in my truck and then drove her car back. So we got back here and we're like, do we want to unload a box of patio furniture and carry it up to the deck? No. So a telehandler into the back of the truck. And then I drove it up to the front and just dropped it right on the deck. Because I'm moving boxes after hanging sheetrock all day.
Look, work smarter, not harder. Nothing wrong with that. It's just a little ridiculous, but awesome at the same time.
Yeah.
I was hoping for some Easter pictures with like an Easter basket hanging off one of the forks and you like driving through the back nine, you know, kids find an egg, they run over, drop it in the basket, hanging off the fork. Yeah. That's.
I feel like Matt is kind of living like the stereotypical boy that grew up in the 80s, maybe even the 70s, dream of like a Tonka truck life.
Oh, I'm getting there.
Yeah, right.
That's what I feel like you're pursuing here.
You do need a dump truck, so yeah.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
You know, I have room for heavy equipment now, so you know, why not just jump into it? I've got the diesel tank here. I mean, come on.
You're all set, man. You got it.
I'm all ready to go. So yeah, that's been awesome. Super helpful for unloading. Cool. I got my forklift from the warehouse sitting at my old house right now to load stuff on the trailer. And then I bring it here and the telehandler just picks everything up all at once. No problem. No unstacking.
It's amazing. Mm. You know, I've got a hand truck and it actually, it converts Like you could use it upright and then you could lay it down flat. And I'm pretty good about that. I might just paint it yellow.
That's a step up. That's a step up from my red wagon. The red wagon doesn't stand up.
Yeah. Good times. I'm so inadequate.
That's such a fun toy, though. Like ever since I started working at a lumber yard, like that's the toy that everyone is like, ooh, look at that. Reaches inside into a semi-trailer and pulls out a couple thousand board feet of lumber. Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah.
Pretty cool. And, I've been using it to reach inside the shop. That's nice.
If you ever need a job, that's a sought after skill right there. Any lumber yard in the country would be happy to have you. Yeah. It's not the same as a forklift, as you know.
Don't you have to be licensed though? Are you licensed?
I am. Okay.
Well, then he's good.
All right. Look at that.
I went through the safety thing. It was
probably a smart idea.
I mean, it was super easy, but
is that like a resort scuba certification where you get certified at the resort
here's
5 minutes.
I think we talked about this at one point. It's a basic online PowerPoint seminar and they talk you through all the safety things. But the little secret they don't tell you is that next to all the items in the PowerPoint that are going to be on the test, they have a very, very small superscript T next to them. So all you have to do is write down those points because it's open notes. So you can take as many notes as you want. So just go through the slides. Any point that had a little T next to it, you wrote that thing down. And sure enough, it was on the test. And I think they're all in the same order as the slides, too. See, it's like I went right down the list.
So you're saying any monkey can do it?
Yeah. I mean, a monkey smart enough to notice those things. Yeah.
Dude, that's great. Okay. Well, hey, if you can become a minister online in like 5 minutes, you should be able to do that quickly, too.
Sure.
Yeah, it's just like don't do dumb stuff. And then with the ride on fork or the ride in forklift, don't ever jump out of it. Just go over with it. That's like, those are the big things.
So like if it's going down, don't.
Yeah. Your safest thing is to stay inside. Do not jump out of it.
It's good to know. I mean, I think my instinct would be to get the hell out. So
yeah. Only if you're on a standing one, those ones you jump out of. But if you're on an actual, like sit down, drive around one. Yeah. You stay inside that rollover cage. Okay.
That's why it's there, right? Okay.
Yep. You know, the thing that always the OSHA inspectors always get our guys is the seatbelt. Like they never put the seatbelt on. Yeah. Cause you're like, it's not like they're like doing 30, not even 20 miles an hour across the yard. You know, it's like 3 miles an hour with a couple thousand pounds of lumber on the front. It's like, and they're always jumping in and jumping out and putting bolsters on and stuff. And it's like that OSHA guy just stands there every time. No seatbelt. Check. It's like, I think we've just kind of resigned ourselves to never get those points on the ocean.
You're always going to fail.
No one's ever going to put the seatbelt on. Right.
Yeah.
That's my biggest thing is the seatbelt. Cause I'm always on and off of it and it buzzes and I don't even hear it anymore.
It's just white noise.
I don't even hear the buzzer. It's just white noise. Yeah. It's because there's the backup alarm and then there's a seatbelt buzzer and the seatbelt buzzer is always going. And then if I put it in reverse, it just beeps. So I'm like,
I think when you have young kids, you get used to ignoring repetitive, annoying sounds. Just as a dad, you got that covered.
100% it. That is 100% it.
Totally jaded at this point.
That's awesome.
I don't even hear this anymore. It's just, it's like the engine sound.
It's going, dad, 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 like that.
No, it's a constant sound.
Okay.
Dad. It's a seatbelt. And then the backup is boop, boop.
There you go. Okay. Well, that's all very fun Tonka truck stuff. Shannon, what do you got going on?
I blame you for this, Mark, because
good.
I was moving some stuff around in the shop and I came across this box and I was like, what is in this box? And I opened it up and it was filled with veneer. And it was a kit that I bought from Paul Schurch back when you did a thing in the guild.
Like an introductory kit. With the interview we did with him.
And I remember at the time, cause it was like
a long time ago.
It was a really good price. And at the time I was like, I don't want to open that rabbit hole, but this is a good price. You know, let's support it. Let's do it. Let's support Paul. You know, I really liked what he did and it kind of like went on a shelf and I forgot all about it. Well, I've since gotten heavily into veneer and playing with marquetry. So I opened this up and it was like a gold mine of veneer, like stuff that Paul selected, you know, it's all in like a large Ziploc bag. So it's like printer paper size sheets at the largest. and lots of tiny little things, heavily figured stuff, some cool dyed stuff, just like a marketeer's dream. And I'm like digging through this, and like every leaf is another like, oh, wow, look at that. Ooh, ooh. And it was like Christmas Day in my shop. So I don't even remember what I went in to do. I was working on a project and I like moved this box from one side to the other. And I was finally like, what is in this thing? And the whole week was lost. Like before I knew it, I had done like 7 hours at my Chevrolet, and like I made a new little double bevel table for my bird's mouth fixture on my bench. And I did like all these little marquetry projects with this cool veneer. So yeah, I lost an entire week thanks to finally finding that packet of veneer that I bought from Paul Church. So yeah, that was awesome.
And I think people, like, once they understand what veneer is and what kind of things are available in veneer, it's not like what you have in a selection of plywood at the home center, right? It's not just like straight grain oak or walnut. It's like the things that are available in veneer format are mind blowing. And it's actually what I find it's difficult to, like, once you have that, once you know what's possible and what kind of patterns are out there, it's actually really a difficult thing to restrain yourself, because it's like, once you see a walnut burl, you're just like, oh my God, I want it everywhere. You know, and it's probably not a good idea to put it everywhere, but it's so amazing. I want to see more of it, but you got to hold back, you know, because some of this stuff is just so visually intense that it's really best for, well, like for marquetry, maybe like small designs and things where you could really use it to punctuate an idea.
And and I don't know that I would have a whole lot of use. Now, granted, if you do really intricate marquetry projects, you know, think of David Marks, like in his, what is that, Triggerfish he just did?
Yeah.
Just ridiculous. There's like 9,000 pieces of veneer in there, and all the different shading that, like, Silas Koff does this as well, where you just, he'll shade from light to dark using like 7 different shades of white wood. And it's just nuts what they do. These little tiny pieces are perfect for that. Me, I've got a local triathlon group that I'm a member of. I just made, like, using the bull technique, I made 8 different, versions of our logo, our club logo, in various veneers. And it's just going to give them to team members, because we have a duathlon thing coming up in a couple of weeks. So it was just like an excuse to play around, just like a simple logo. But it was just way fun, because I've got these cool veneers and tiny little pieces, like 3-inch square pieces that I don't know what else I would do with it. So yeah, it was a fun distraction.
That is pretty sweet. All right. So I had an idea. I thought it'd be fun to see if you guys, you two specifically, if you guys,
you're not part of this.
Well, someone has to ask the questions. Like, what am I? I thought about this. I'm like, how am I supposed to do this with all three of us? One of us has to ask questions, and luckily that's me. So
of course it is.
Say it again. What?
Of course it is.
Yeah. So this is from howstuffworks.com. They have some quizzes there. This one in particular is called "How much do you know about woodworking?" All right. So a nail set. I'm going to target these, Matt, and I'm just going to keep score for a little bit. By the way, this is like infinite questions. We could be here forever, and we're not going to be.
Let's not do that.
So Matt, I'm going to put you on the spot here. Ready? A nail set is used to do what? Now, it is multiple choice. Should I read them, or you guys want to just try to go for it?
I mean, is setting nails an option?
It is, and that is the correct answer. Wow. Good job, Matt.
Ding, 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 ding.
All right. I'm a little worried that they're going to have like the answers like wrong, because they have no idea what they're talking about.
On a website
about.
Like this, probably. Right. Yeah. How stuff works, we think. Okay, so what is a rasp, Shannon?
What is a rasp? A piece of metal.
What is a rasp?
How do you describe a rasp is? Piece of metal with teeth stitched into it.
According to How Stuff Works, you describe it as a long, flat steel file with raised teeth. The judges officially say that that's correct. You got it. Yes, for that.
But I said stitched, so I actually know how the teeth are made. So
what if it's a radius rasp, though?
Nope. Stop it. We're going to the next one, Matt.
Oh, okay. No.
How do moisture and climate conditions affect wood?
How they feel, like, okay, it makes them expand and contract. Is that what you mean?
Okay, I got to give you all the choices: contraction, expansion, bowing, or all of the above.
All of the above.
All of the above.
It has to be one of those.
Oh, very good. Ding, ding, ding. Nice job. Okay, back to Shannon. What is a C-clamp used for?
Clamping.
I'm
going
to give you the choices. It's to work on large projects like doors, to hold mitered corners of picture frames, to hold materials in place while working, to clamp trim to the edges of plywood. There is no all of the above.
Oh, okay.
C-clamp.
Well, you wouldn't clamp trim.
Nope.
I suppose you really wouldn't clamp miters with it, unless your miters aren't flat. What was the other option? Build projects? What was the other one?
To work on large projects like doors, or to hold materials in place while working.
That one.
Yes!
Hold materials
good job!
In place while working.
That one.
All right, we're going to do one more question each.
It's just a really big C-clamp.
That's true.
Yeah, really, yeah.
You guys clearly know your stuff. What skills... Hold on. Is this proper English? What skills... Yes. What skills does woodworking include? Whittling, carving, wood turning, or all of the above? That's for Matt.
That's the only skills.
Whittling, carving, wood turning, or all of the above?
Yes, it's all joinery. That's fine. Okay, we'll just do all of the above.
Okay.
And then some.
Yeah, very good. That is the answer. Okay, final question for Shannon. You have to tie. Your reputation is on the line. How is a coping saw used? To cut with the grain of the wood, for precision veneer work, for rough cutting wood, or for precision and intricate cuts?
The last one.
Correct!
I mean,
nice job!
I don't think I would have chosen any of those, but okay.
All right, well, there you go. Oh, hold on. This one's got to be from... this is just funny. What famous fairy tale character is made of wood? Woody Woodpecker, Pinocchio, Barbie, or G.I. Joe?
Pinocchio.
Correct!
Pinocchio.
That is right. Pinocchio. Very good, Matt. And that is...
Why would I not know that?
Oh, I don't know. But I'm going to say Matt wins because I'm not giving Shannon another question. So... There you go. Congratulations,
he wins because
Matt.
He had more questions to answer.
Congratulations, Matt. Nicely done. You win a no prize.
Well played, sir.
You win nothing.
Well,
all right.
Okay, so let's
good
get
game.
Let's move on with the show. 500 episodes. We're entitled to do something stupid.
That was dumb.
It was. Look, I'm trying here, guys.
I don't know if anyone would find that entertaining or not.
Oh, they will. You watch. You watch, my friend. I'm looking for the next
voicemail. You overestimate our audience.
Yeah. Okay, so we do have some voicemails and emails, your questions, of course, but we're going to start with a voicemail here from Jeremiah, who has some insight on 500 shows and then a question about workbench height.
Hi, Mark, Shannon, and Matt. This is Jeremiah from Minneapolis, Minnesota, calling in with a little bit of feedback and a question. So I am new to this hobby. In fact, but for a global pandemic, I would be blissfully unaware of woodworking, which has become really a new obsession for me. I want to thank you all for a tremendous show. It's taught me an incredible amount in a short period of time. So as you approach episode 500, or pass episode 500, depending on how many weeks it takes for this to get on air, I do think it's important to recognize a huge milestone and tell you how much fun it is to go backwards in time and listen to you all talk about different things when I have knowledge of the future. So a few observations. One, Mark, you are just as bad at pronouncing Patreon names as Matt is. Two, the old title intro announcer guy sounds a lot like Kramer from Seinfeld pretending to be a movie phone. So I approve of the switch. Three, Shannon at one point expressly stated that the wood talk would not quit in the next year, only to immediately then quit in the next year. And four, the idea of the,
wasn't it like the next episode?
Update about the lumber industry becoming a regular segment, being sarcastically dismissed as incredibly boring, only to grow into its full-fledged podcast that I enjoy greatly. So really, thank you all so much for the show. So now for the question. I've reached the point where I need to build a proper bench. I do some power tool work, but mostly for hand tools. And I'm trying to figure out the right bench height. So unlike my fellow Minnesotan Matt, I consider myself to be full sized at 6'7" and some knuckle dragging arm length. So the internet tells me the Schwarz method says pinky height, but due to my aforementioned knuckle dragging, that puts the bench at about 29 inches off the ground, which obviously is a non-starter. I tried setting something up at about 34 inches, seems to be more of a standard height, and my back tells me that that is far too low for me as well. So with you knowing the issues, how would you go about figuring out the right height for the bench? Shannon, I assume your bench is a little taller. How did you arrive at that height? I think I'm better off having a bench that's too high rather than too low, but I don't know what I don't know. So thanks again for the show, and I look forward to your feedback.
It's interesting because I don't think those rules of thumb account for monkey arms.
No, yeah.
You know, no, like if you just have slightly longer than usual arms that way, like that I could see that could be a real pain in the butt when that's too low for him.
I have to say in Matt's defense, though, if the candy bar isn't full sized, it's fun sized. So
that's right.
Hey, congrats, Matt. You're fun sized.
He's the fun sized member of the
most
show.
Fun person here. Yeah.
Or fun sized.
So I think the key to his question is at the beginning when he says he does mostly power tools and mm-hmm. not and a little bit of hand tools, which to me means he dimensions his lumber probably using power tools. And yep. The only reason to have a bench lower is for planing, like surface planing, milling boards flat, not even edge work, because you're usually putting that in a vise and you can prop that up as high as you want. And that's where the difficulty comes. If you try to hand plane a board and the board is, or the bench is too high, you can't use your legs. It all becomes your arms and shoulders. It tires you out, but it also will, you'll get all kinds of other problems. It can be difficult to actually flatten a board when you're just using your arms. You tend to taper boards more than anything else. So if that is true, and he's using a power joiner and a planer, I would say 36 inches. That would probably be where I would start. And the reason his back is hurting with it, what is it, 32 or 34, he said, is because most of his work is like standing shoulder square to the bench and like literally having to bend over doing router operations or even chisel operations, even back saw operations. I would say go a little bit higher. But I ran into this with my joinery bench because I knew that was going to be a totally different height than anything else in the shop. And the best way I did it was actually to build my bench top first. And then before I moved to the legs, I used saw horses and some blocks and things and actually set it at different heights and actually worked on the bench, like cut some joinery, spent a good few hours working on another project at that particular height. And then I changed it again and messed around with it. So with a full size bench, you know, it's a good idea just to build the top first, because then you can actually build the legs on the top you just built. Get some saw horses. If you don't have saw horses, build them or go buy some of those plastic Stanley ones. My Rubo sat on plastic Stanley saw horses for almost 2 years because I kept building other projects as I was messing with the height. And you can really get a feel for it. But he's right. It'd be better to be higher than lower. If nothing else, make your if you're putting a lower shelf or like a lower stretcher, make that a little bit higher so you've got room to actually trim the legs later. If you decide this bench is an inch too tall, you can trim an inch off the bottom of those legs and drop it down. But it's a little bit harder to add material back onto the legs and stand it up taller again. So I would personally start at 36 inches. Play with that for a while and see what you think. Sorry, I just kind of took that question.
Is Heather downloading bootleg content? Because you're getting all Skypey on us.
Yeah, you're dropping off every now and then.
Yeah, go yell at her.
No, no, no. I think she's teaching voice lessons, actually.
Well, that might actually be more important than the show. How tall did this guy say he was?
6'7".
Hey, oh, 6'7". Okay. So I'm going to say at least 36 inches. Like if he wants to check it out, go to your kitchen. Your countertops are probably in that ballpark of about 36 inches. You can kind of use that just as a quick reference to see, would this be a comfortable height to operate a router, you know, or some other kind of power tool. My workbench, and I'm only maybe 5'11", 5'10 and a half. My workbench is 35 inches. So only going 1 inch, and this dude is 6'7". Yeah. I feel like he's got to go maybe a little bit taller than that, a couple inches higher than that. But start with those kitchen cabinets and go to the countertops in your kitchen and see if that feels right, or at least if it's closer to what you need, and go from there.
Bring the router in there and start routing some mortises. And
that's right.
There you go.
Yeah, just turn on the hood over the stove, collect all that dust, you'll be good to go. Good stuff. All right. Where else are we here? Okay, so let's get into these questions that we have. I think you're up first, Shannon.
Elliot says he's been Googling Rubo Workbench. He spells it R-O-O-B-O-H. Googling Rubo Workbench is unsatisfactory. So in 25 words or less, what the hell is a Rubo Workbench and how do you spell it? Well, it is spelled R-O-U-B-O, named after André Rubo, an 18th century French cabinet maker who just so happened to make a really, really stout workbench. And Christopher Schwarz wrote a book about it. It was blue. And suddenly Rubo became like a household name. And yeah, that's what it is. It's just a really, really stout workbench. It's a workbench that uses a slab top instead of an apron. So if you hear somebody say a Rubo versus an English workbench or a Rubo versus a Nicholson workbench, they're talking about two cabinet makers. One was English, one was French. And the French workbench is a Rubo workbench. So if you Google R-O-U-B-O workbench, you will find more. I think like 60% of the internet might be right there. It's all right there.
Which is kind of amazing. Further, you can truly really attribute that to Chris Schwarz.
It's all Chris. Yeah. That one book in 2008, mm-hmm. 2007, I think, when that book came out. And yeah, we all now know what Rubo is. So yeah, very dumb question. Good job, Elliot.
a very good, dumb question.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So the next one here is a voicemail and it is directed at Matt, but I have to play it. So.
Hey guys, it's Nick here, also known as Mr. Build Everything by very few people. A couple years ago, you answered my question about coming up with a moniker. And since then, you may have noticed me harassing you on social media as Mr. Build Everything. My question today is for Matt about his nice bit of kit, the 20-inch planer. I got the same one last year. And I noticed his doesn't have the stock infeed and outfeed rollers that come with it. Did you take those off to save space? And do you use an alternative, like a pop-up roller stand or something? I want to take my stock ones off to save room, but I don't want to get snipe as a result. So what do you do? Also, do you recommend the spiral or helical cutter head upgrade? I've watched your video a few times, and I really don't want to do it, but I really want a spiral cutter head. So please convince me to do it, because I know it'll be great. So thanks for doing the show and take care.
Please just do it.
I know you want to.
Yeah. So if you're not familiar with my planer, it's like the older style that does not have the actual infeed and outfeed tables, like cast iron tables. Basically, it just has like two outriggers that have a roller on it to support the work as it's going in and out of the planer. I have them for mine. I never installed them, because they take up way, way more space. Like if anyone has a stationary planer with the tables, you know that that planer is a lot deeper or a lot wider, whichever way you're looking at it. So I just never installed them. And yeah, you don't need them is what I learned. So what I do is I'm like a production shop. So every board I put through, I'm going to be hand feeding it in and hand receiving it out. So I'm the one basically being the outfeed support through all the cuts. Mm-hmm. And that's going to help me reduce snipe, because I pick up on the boards as they're going in and as they're coming out. And I don't really have a whole lot of snipe issues, and I don't have as big of a footprint for that machine. The spiral head is, yes, that's worth it. You should probably do that. Just get it out of the way. It's not the install process is really not that bad. I think it took me like 4 hours or 5 hours or something like that. And I didn't have a nice little video that shows you how to do it. Wink, wink. So you just kind of go through the process. And if you're at all, if you know how to work a wrench, you're right, lefty loosey, righty tighty, you should be okay. It's not too, it's really not that bad.
Do you need a, like a gear puller for that?
I gotta go back and watch the video. I don't think anything needed to be pulled.
Mm-hmm. Cause I had to do that on my jointer, and it was one of the tools that I was like, I don't do anything with cars. Right. So something like a gear puller or anything that would require bearings to be pulled off of a shaft is not in my wheelhouse. So when I saw that in the instructions, I was like, well, that's a tool I need to buy. I don't have that.
Yeah. And I think the pulley that was on the actual shaft that slid right off, it did need to be pulled. And then the bearings, they stay with the old cutter head.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Because then you put new bearings on completely so that the bearings never get pulled off the old cutter head.
Okay. That's
at least on mine. I don't know what the other ones are like.
And to be clear, like I have the cast iron tables on my 20-inch planer. And
right. Yeah, so you know how much bigger that thing is.
Yeah. It triples the footprint. also adds about 200 pounds, if maybe more than that. So it does add a lot of mass, but it's totally unnecessary. In fact, what I find is like with any horizontal surface in the shop, it ends up being a place where you stick stuff. And all it does is, you know, I've got good dust collection on it right next to it, but you still get dust on those things. So it's just another surface that I've got to like deal with rust prevention. I'm seriously thinking about getting rid of them. I probably could sell them in a, you know, heartbeat. Cause somebody
sell to the scrapyard.
We've been told we have to have them or you're going to get snipe. And the, first of all, the bed itself is so big on that planer. I mean, it's 20 inches wide. First of all, wider than that technically. And probably at least 24 inches long, I would think.
Yeah.
So you've got so much surface area already. And I don't know if you said it or not. I think you said it in passing. If you pull up on the board on the out feed side, you're not going to get snipe. It's like Matt said, in a production shop, if the board is just let to roll, that downward kind of cantilevered force is what creates the snipe. It's real easy to avoid snipe if you're catching the board. Just pull up.
Right.
Yeah.
In those production shops, they're just sending them through and no one's on the other side receiving. Fall on the floor or whatever.
Well, and if you don't want them to fall on the floor, I mean, there's options. Roller stands, right? Roller stands are good for this kind of thing.
You can do that, yes.
For the occasion where he actually needs it, a little plug for our friends over at Rockler. If you go to the website and search, use different words like outfeed support or roller stand, do a couple of those searches, you will find a bunch of different options. They've got their own ball bearing stand. They've got I actually have this one, the heavy duty flip stop. So it's got one side that's a roller and then one side that has the little balls. I like a lot of little balls, and that's the one I use the most. They've got the Triton tripod support stand. And then they have this actually might be good for the planer. It's a lot like the heavy duty standard flip one, except for it's got three rows of ball bearings. So one single stand with three rows worth of support is a really good option for either outfeed on really any power tool, but certainly at the planer as well, and can kind of, you know, especially if you're working alone. And I don't know, for me, sometimes I like having the extra table length there because I'm trying to feed things together and make a steady flow of stuff going through the planer.
Right.
I may not be able to get to the outfeed to catch it in time and get it back on top of the planer for the next round.
That's a good point. Yeah.
It's also nice when you've got smaller parts, like when the parts are small enough that actually won't fall off the other side.
Yeah.
You know, think of like rails and stiles. And this is actually when I use my planer the most, when I have like 20 pieces that I need to be the same size. Yeah. Otherwise I'm doing it by hand. Right. So so they're 2 inches wide and I always in the back of my head, I'm hearing like use the whole cutter head. So you don't just dull that one spot that I always use. Yeah. So I'm feeding them through like side by side by side. And you know, on a 20-inch planer, I've got like 8 rails going across the thing and I'm just not nimble enough to catch them all. So it is nice to have the table, but even then, you know, I wonder, could I take them off the outfeed side? Because that's going to get me 3 feet of space in my shop.
That's a move big
the planer. Yeah, it really is.
All right, so real quick, I'm going to play a couple seconds of Nick's other voicemail where he basically left the entire same voicemail in a Russian accent. So we're not going to play the whole thing, but, you know, the guy went through the effort. We got to play it, right? So.
Привет. This is Mr. Build Everything. I make this moniker after you answered video question a couple years ago. And since then, I harass you on social media as Mr. Build Everything.
Okay, so like to me that just sounds like Borat.
Very nice.
Okay, well thanks for that, Nick.
It's especially funny when he gets into his question. Don't play it. We've got don't play it. But it's just like, you know, why Spiral? He's good. Yeah. It's just so like so Bullwinkle. Sorry.
Yeah.
Boris and Natasha.
It's pretty good though. I like it. Okay, so I got a question here from Alex. He says, I have a question about bow tie inlays. I know how to do them and what they're for and all that. I have other questions like, is there a standard depth that they should go into? Okay, I'm going to actually answer these as we go. And you guys, I might need help from you two because I actually haven't done a lot of these. So I'm just kind of going based on what I've seen and what makes sense to me. Is there a standard depth that they should go into the wood to stop cracks? A lot of times it doesn't seem like people really go very deep, like a quarter inch maybe, but I would say you probably want to get, my gut tells me at least a third of the thickness, right? Because I mean, in the ideal world, if you could just put a bow tie all the way through, that's going to be the strongest, the best solution, but it's really generally unrealistic to route or even do it by hand and go all the way through. So I would try to at least get a third. Now, do you guys know if there's any formulas for this or rules of thumb as to what will work and won't work?
My general thing is a third-ish.
A third? And if you can hit a half, even better? Yeah.
It's like it's to the point where it's like the deeper you go, the more annoying it gets.
Yeah.
And if you're actually doing it, the question is like, are you doing it for like structural or are you doing it for like more decorative?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's like a big crack that you're not going to fill with epoxy and not do anything else with, you're going to want to stitch it from both sides anyway. Right. So if you can get through a third, maybe a half if you really want to, that's probably going to be the best way to go. Because going all the way through is like on something that's like, let's say 2 inches thick.
Yeah, it's kind of
and having it like not look terrible on both sides.
Yeah. But who cares about the bottom?
Some people do.
I think it actually some people would want to
have their pet skills
to
look at it.
Like if you go all the way through, it actually is a little bit harder to do.
Yeah. Oh, it's incredibly harder to do.
Yeah, you've got all the blowout on the backside, or you've got to like precisely line up the bow tie on both faces so you can go at it from both faces, and that's just ridiculous.
Like, that's not going to happen.
That sounds like no fun.
Especially because it's probably a live edge or an unusual, a not straight edge. So yeah going all the way through, no. No.
Okay, second part of his question, he says, should the wood that you use for the inlay be a harder species than the wood that it's going into? I'm going to say that it doesn't have to be, but it probably benefits from being a denser species, a more robust species. You're using it to kind of lock this thing in place. So if it is a more durable wood or a harder species, I don't think that that's a bad thing necessarily. And also it's typically used as an accent. So it's not that hard to find something that might be a denser species and also have the appearance that you want in there. But I don't think it has to be a different harder species. Yeah. Anyone disagree with that?
I don't think it matters.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. What's the next part? Does grain direction matter? This is an absolute yes. If you're going across a crack, you would want the grain direction of the bow tie to be perpendicular to the crack, right? So you're going to orient the bow tie perpendicular. And then that's also the same direction from front to back of the bow tie itself. That's the direction you want the grain. If the grain is short grain all the way across that bow tie, it's going to be incredibly weak. It's probably going to break at some point. So yes, absolutely.
Yeah. When you're hammering it in.
Yeah, right. That's when it'll break, right? Whoops. Okay, well, just put some glue in there. It'll be fine. And he wants to know if he's overthinking this. No, I don't think so at all. I think these are appropriate questions to ask if you've never done it before. And if since I haven't done many of these are all questions I would ask myself before starting it. Couple really important questions at the end here. Why is Mark so handsome? Why is Matt so hairy? Why is Shannon so smart? And he says some of these are more important than others. So we can't help it. It's just who we are. You're up, Matt.
I know.
Just giving me that awkward pause. I love it.
I'm working here. All right.
Trying to get
I got a persona to preserve.
Yeah.
This one's from Brian. Brian's been looking into doing some Morrison tenon furniture, but the hollow chisel mortises are fairly pricey. Why can't I just grind off the sides of a drill bit and make it square and do the same thing? Would this work better in a hammer drill to help cut the square profile? Why want to answer this one? So if you haven't seen the actual bit for a hollow chisel mortiser, what it is a square chisel with a hole in the middle with the flutes on the inside, and then the auger is what actually pulls all the waste out of it. So just grinding a drill bit square isn't really going to do anything because you don't have any way to evacuate the material. What you could do, I guess, if you want to goal this way is you can somehow drill a hole in the end of a drill bit, which sounds impossible. And tickle that and then make that sharp.
I see where you're going.
I mean, but the other thing you can do if you like really don't want to buy the machine, you can buy the bits, I guess, and you can manually turn the auger and hammer the bejesus out of the chisel into the work.
No, don't do that.
That wouldn't work. Don't do that.
Just don't do that.
I don't think any of this is a good idea.
No, I mean,
just if you're going to go to that trouble, just get a mortising chisel, for God's sake.
I don't know. Some people are like, you know what? I can go through the hassle and all the pain and trouble in the world to save $200.
Yeah. I mean, really, to reiterate, the only reason you could use a drill to make a square hole in the first place is because it's a two part bit. Right. So you've got
the drill is surrounded by something else.
Yeah. The tool itself has a second mechanism, not just a chuck for the bit, but there's something holding that square chisel around it. It's much more complicated than a single bit operation. So I don't know how in any way that is sensible that you could do this with a single bit.
No, but because the chisel doesn't spin either.
Right. Yeah. Because, well, as soon as you spin it, well, now it's still going to be circular.
And I suppose a hammer drill would work if you actually hammered on the drill. If you chucked it up in the drill and took a hammer to the back of the hammer drill.
Yeah, just use the drill just to hold the bit. Yeah, that'd be good.
Well, I mean, the hammer drill, so you can put it in its hammer mode with no spinning. So there's that. I mean, this is just, don't do this.
Good try, though. Good try. All right. Well,
go get a Morrison chisel and talk to Shannon.
Yeah,
there you go.
All right. Well, you know who else is thinking about outdoor finishes?
What?
What?
That's right, Rockler.
Failed segue.
That was 100% intentional. You could start building outdoor furniture for your space with help from your good friends at Rockler. Rockler offers outdoor furniture templates and hardware for several different designs, including Adirondack chairs, a portable outdoor chair, an English garden bench, and more. You can also find tips and tricks for your projects, including choosing the best woods for outdoor furniture and choosing the best finish. Find everything that you need to start building your projects at stores, of course, or at rockler.com. Take advantage of this, guys, because outdoor furniture is just not as easy as you might think it is. So find out what woods you need to use, find out what finishes work, which ones don't. Ask the folks at Rockler. They're going to help you out. And it is that time of year to start thinking about that outdoor furniture stuff. So there you go. Go check them out at rockler.com. And thank you very much for sponsoring the show, Rockler. We appreciate it. And thanks for being relevant to the topic of the show today. Pretty good.
Go Rockler.
Oh, man.
Yay. Go Rockler. Okay. So I've got a question here from Tommaso. And this might be, you might think, an odd question for me to answer, but I'm going to do it anyway. If I have a board in my leg vise to joint the edge, how should I address the board? To the side? Behind? Which hand should be where on the plane? What's my motion? Am I using my legs, my abs, my arms to push? I'll answer this. And of course, Shannon being our resident hand tool expert, if any comments on the body English here are incorrect, please correct me. So generally speaking, you want a plane into the vise. Okay, so if you are right-handed and your vise, as you're staring at your bench, if your vise, leg vise, is on the left-hand side, you're going to pop the piece of wood in there with most of the board going to your right, and you are going to address the board planing into the vise. If you plane out of the vise, it's kind of the weakest direction to plane. You could pull the board out, but planing in, it kind of just seems to wedge itself in there. So you plane into the vise. For me personally, and I probably don't even have great form when it comes to something like this, I do like to use as little of my upper body as possible, right? So if I can get that, and this is where bench height, you know, can play a factor into this stuff. I like to get it up so that my arms are, you know, fairly bent. I don't want to be locked in any position. I want to be sort of in a comfortable bent position, and I will almost walk it through the cut. And I don't necessarily want to force it with my upper body. I'm using my lower body. A lot of, you know, energy from my torso is going into it, and my arms are fairly well, you know, held in position. Maybe toward the end of the cut, you might see me extend my arms to finish that cut. And I'm basically going from right to left into the vise and walking through the cut. And I think if you're doing a lot of this, which I don't, so I can afford to have bad form because I'm not doing a whole lot of it.
But there you go.
Yeah. If you're doing a lot of this, that form really matters. You know, this is something that can really be taxing on your body if you aren't used to it and you're doing it improperly. So it's a good idea to get that form down, do it properly so that you could, you know, have the longevity to do a lot of this stuff. So anything you'd add to that, Shannon?
No, spot on. Other than like sore back and things like that, if the height is wrong, if you don't have that elbow kind of cocked at 90 degrees and tucked up against your body, that's how you're, you know, using your legs and your hips to propel it. It also can cause balance issues with the plane, and that's how you end up tapering the board on the far end. So the other thing I say is if you're taking a planing pass that's more than about 18 inches, you want to move your feet. If you plant your feet and just push and like extend your body out, there's a lot of weight on the toe of that plane and you will actually take a deeper cut on the end of that pass. So you get these people that plane and plane and plane, and then they check the board and it's like a quarter inch thinner on the far side of the board because of that. You got to move your feet. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of footwork and planing as well, which again, if the bench is too high, that's really difficult to do.
And also I forgot to answer, which hand should be where? You pretty much have two places on most planes. You've got a little knob at the front and you have a handle at the back, and your right hand should be at the back. Your left hand should be at the front. And that's generally for the most part. I mean, you might find, you know, weird people like Matt want to stick his finger somewhere. Right. So he can't
have to put it somewhere.
He can't have a low angle plane.
This feels so weird.
A bevel up plane just throws him off. He needs a frog. So, I mean, but that's your basic position, but play with it, because sometimes just moving your hand a little bit or gripping the plane in a non-traditional way might actually be more comfortable for you, and whatever works, you know, whatever.
I like to put my front hand like below the handle, like directly on the body, and like have my fingers wrap underneath.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. Yep. If you're talking about jointing a board. Absolutely.
Jointing. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. It's funny because I will put my thumb right behind the front knob, like Matt says, right on the plane body itself. And that downward pressure of my thumb can actually, I don't want to say feel square, but at this point, I've been doing it long enough, I can feel square. But if the board is relatively square already, like, you know, say you're cleaning up a power jointed edge, it's already square, that pressure down will actually hold the plane and make the plane kind of conform to the contour, the topography that already exists. It's a subtle thing, but anybody who says I started with a square board, like off my joiner, and when I try to clean it up with a hand plane, I end up taking it out of square, shift your thumb down to the plane itself. And just, you can feel as the plane moves along the board, it's a lot more control. It's kind of like choking up on the bat, if you will. You've got the ability to control that plane a lot more.
Okay. All right, next one we have here is a voicemail from Robin.
Hey guys, longtime caller, first time listener, Robin Wenger here in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Hey Shannon! Anyway, I have a question about making a treadle lathe. I have the treadle from an old sewing machine, but the flywheel is on my right, which means that if I put a headstock on top, the headstock would be on the right. Yes, I could turn it around, but there are cross braces on the backside of the treadle. And yes, I could take it apart and turn it inside out and put it all back together, but that might just be crazy. So is there any reason that I can't have a lathe with the headstock on my right side? Is that just a matter of right-handedness versus left-handedness? I am right-handed, but is that just a matter of adaptation? I'm curious, so please let me know. Thanks.
I like this question. This is a good, dumb question. Like, this is exactly what we're going for here.
We're still doing this?
Yeah, is this still yeah, I thought we were done with the dumb questions.
I can't find a reason why it should matter. And his point at the end about, is it a left-handed versus right-handed thing? Well, I am left-handed. And I often find that just because I've had to adapt, I end up doing certain things right-handed because it was awkward. But I do turn left-handed, I guess, where my left hand is down on the butt of the tool. My right hand is up by the tool rest, which I think is opposite of a right-handed person, right? You've got your right hand down.
Yeah, it sounds backwards.
And your left hand.
Very, very backwards.
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure I'm turning left-handed. And the only thing I think of, well, if the headstock's on my left, would it get in the way? And it never has, because I'm never turning that close. Like even with faceplate turning, I'm still kind of coming. No, it's never been an issue. So I can't imagine having the headstock on the right would pose an issue to a right-handed turner. I've done a lot of historical research on treadle lathes when I did a whole semester on them at the hand tool school. Never once saw one with the flywheel on the right-hand side, but that doesn't mean anything. That just may mean, I don't know, somebody built it one way on the left and no one ever thought anything about it. I can't imagine why that would be a problem. So I would say go for it. And maybe you'll find out why after you've built it.
Let us know.
Right.
All right. This is from Eric. How do you know when it's safe to route end grain? I've heard that routing end grain can be dangerous and that the bit can grab the wood, but routing end grain seems to be common enough. I myself have experienced this both ways. I route a lot of end grain on a piece of poplar recently. It was fine. For a different project, I was making a decorative letter E for my wife's anniversary. The letter has a maple core and the front and back faces are walnut. I rough cut the letter and then used an MDF template to flush trim bit to achieve the final shape. And then I grabbed the wood and the bit grabbed the wood and almost threw it out of my hand. Is the safety of the procedure dependent on the hardness of the wood, i.e. harder woods are less safe and softer woods are more safe? Any input would be great. So I guess we're talking about kind of routing against the grain and going uphill in this sense, I would think. Is that kind of the gist of what you're going? Because routing end grain, I'm thinking like originally it was like we had the router sitting on top of the board going directly into the end grain. I'm guessing it's like template routing with like reversing grain direction.
Generally speaking, he's talking whether you're doing a right angle that transitions to end grain, somehow end grain is being, you know, brought into play. Like
cutting across end grain,
the shape of an E makes me nervous, like really nervous thinking about a router bit going around that shape.
I think with a lot of that too, is you have to keep in mind, like as you're coming across that, you're going from long grain into end grain. And with an E, you have like short grain areas. Let's assume like your board runs the height of the E. So mm-hmm. every little, what are we going to call those little pieces that stick out from the stick? the protrusions. The three thingies on the E sticking out of the end there. Those are all going to be short grain. So they're going to be very weak. And as you're coming around the corner there and you come into that area, you're going into the end grain or into the long grain there, and you're gonna end up like probably break one of those things off. So I think when you look at this kind of stuff, I think it's gonna depend a lot too on the style of bit you're using. Yeah. If you're using just a standard straight flute, straight bit, that bit is presenting to that end grain at like square on. If you have more like a spiral bit, that's gonna actually shear through there, and that's gonna be a lot safer, and it's probably gonna give you a much cleaner cut too. I don't really have a whole lot of experience doing like weird shapes like this. Normally when I see this as an issue is when you're doing like pattern routing, like a curve as you're coming down the hill, like on one side, you're going to go with the grain. And then if you keep going, you're going to come against the grain as you're going uphill on the other side. And in those cases, yes, it can grab and throw it. So it's like the bit you're using is probably the biggest one. If you want to do these things, I definitely recommend some kind of spiral bit with some kind of shearing cut and not a standard straight bit. Mm-hmm. That's going to be a whole heck of a lot less, I'll say less dangerous or less grabby in a sense. And I don't know. It all just sounds terrible, personally.
It can be scary. It could be kind of
routing a little E. Like, that's just like, I'm going to see like the bit just like taking that chunk and throwing it.
Well, you got right the grain problems. You got a very weak connection to the vertical part of the E that's at risk. It's just, it's kind of asking too much. You guys know William Ng's Big Daddy bit?
Yeah.
All right. So it's a big, giant, massive spiral bit, multiple flutes. And when I was at his shop, and just to give you kind of perspective on this, Eric, I still look at end grain at times and go, yep, I'm not hitting that with a router bit. Like there's certain things I just will not do. Even just let's say I'm flush trimming a square corner and I'm going from long grain, transitioning around the corner to end grain. I still get very nervous about that. But if you have a spiral bit and it's a good quality sharp bit, and you are doing this in a continuous motion, right? You never take the bearing off of the template. It actually can work remarkably well. And I've seen William do this in the hands of someone who's confident, who's done it a million times. Watching him use the Big Daddy bit on a 2-inch thick workpiece, basically think like a chair leg or something. And he's wrapping around, he's going down a long grain, everything's fine. And then he just makes that transition to a short 2-inch wide piece of end grain, 2-inch thick.
He put that on his Instagram like a month ago.
Oh, really?
Or something. He was doing like a chair leg where it's kind of like a Maloof kind of thing or something where like the little stub that goes into the rail is still there.
Yeah.
He's coming down the length of the leg and then like, oh, great. There's a little bit of like, you're changing, you're going right to end grain. Whoop, right on the corner, turns 90 degrees and comes out. I'm like, oh my, I would look at them oh, I don't like where this is going. And he's like, fine. Like,
yeah, what? He did that. And I'm like,
this should not be.
I was like, that doesn't look safe, William. I don't want to do that. But I watched him do it so many times and it truly is dicey. And the reason it's dicey is because it relies on you not taking that bearing off of the template. You pull the bearing off the template and then re-engage on that end grain. Now you're in trouble, right? So this is really one that is a nuanced thing with an experienced set of hands being able to pull it off. But anytime you have just full on end grain, you should be cautious about it. And if you're going to do it, you got to make sure you have like no more than a 16th of an inch proud of your template. And you got to be using good spiral bit and make sure it's nice and sharp to make sure that that's safe enough to do. But it can be done. Just don't let that bearing come off. All right. Well, I think that does it for us, guys. Remember that we are proudly sponsored by Rockler. They're a family-owned company since 1954, and they're your go-to source for high-quality and innovative woodworking tools, finishing supplies, hardware, lumber, and expert advice. Whether you're building a simple bookshelf, a custom desk, or new kitchen cabinets, Rockler has everything you need to make your next project a success. Visit Rockler.com and use the code WOODTALK, that's all one word, to receive free shipping on most orders over $39. And remember to head over to Rockler.com/WOODTALK to enter for your chance to win. What is that? I put the wrong product in there. It's the Material Mate panel cart and shop stands. Great little thing to have in the shop.
Very cool. Yeah, we didn't talk about that earlier on the show, did we? Or was I just not listening? I knew there was a giveaway, but I don't remember what it was.
It was so during the intro.
The intro, yeah.
I just wasn't paying attention. No, go figure.
Just scroll up in the notes.
Yeah, I could do that, but I won't. So, we joke and we call this the dumb question episode, or I don't know what we called it, but that's what we pretended it was. It's actually really good. I thought we had some really good questions that people might be afraid to ask, and we actually got to talk woodworking on the show, which was kind of fun. So keep those dumb questions coming. We appreciate that. And please, if you go to woodtalkshow.com, you can leave a comment there, you can submit a question, or you can just send us an email to woodtalkshow@gmail.com, or you could certainly do it via Instagram, although I haven't checked Instagram to see if there's any questions coming. I'm assuming Margaret's doing that. So you can submit questions via Instagram. We just may not see them. Yeah.
Hopefully. We'll see how that works out. Margaret's busy. All right. Well, thank you for listening, everybody, and we will catch you next time.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.